The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Hello and welcome to another Yes to Life show, the show that focuses on integrative medicine for cancer. I'm Robin Daly, founder of the charity Yes to Life, which I set up 13 years ago to help people with cancer to find out about and use integrative medicine to help themselves. My guest this week has been campaigning vigorously for a key change in the way dentistry operates. David Harvey Austin has been working through the British Society for Mercury-Free Dentistry to bring about a public health victory that was announced this last week, a partial ban on the use of mercury amalgam. I'm talking to David over Skype. Hi David, thanks very much for coming on the Yes to Life show today.
It's my pleasure, nice to talk to you.
Okay, so we're going to be talking about a subject that I think has occupied quite a chunk of your life, mercury amalgam fillings.
Yeah, about 35 odd years.
35, okay. Now, there was a time in which doctors practiced what they call heroic medicine, administering practically fatal doses of toxins or removing vast chunks of the body with surgery. I think that, in fact, they imagined themselves as the heroes of the piece, but of course it was the patients who were the real heroes. We're talking about 150, 200 years ago, but it's long been the case that mercury has been recognised as one of the most hazardous materials on the planet, and therefore to be avoided if possible. So how on earth did the bright idea emerge of fixing some permanently in people's mouths, of all places? How did that come about, and how has it survived as a practice in the face of the evidence of harm?
Well, there seems to have been, up until amalgam was available, which was brought in from French dentists, gold was the only alternative, which is very expensive for most people.
Right.
And so when they brought it in, the American Society of Dental Surgeons didn't like it because of mercury poisoning. They then split up with the National Dental Association, became later the American Dental Association. That was the problem. So some people were for it, some people were against it. A lot of it, I think, was financially won out in the end.
Right. But it stayed there all these years.
Well, there hadn't been anything until... I mean, composites first came in the 70s. They were not very effective, and they were very technique difficult to use.
Mm-hmm.
In the 80s, they got a bit better. In the 90s, they got even better. And now they're pretty well okay. But until that point in time, there wasn't an alternative, really.
Oh, right. Okay, well, that begins to make a little sense. So, this week, you're kind of in celebratory mode, I think. Would you like to tell us about the really significant milestone that's been reached?
This is the first part of a treaty that they've been negotiating for about the last 5 years, and they're at least recognising that amalgam can be a problem for... especially on children and pregnant and lactating mothers. And it's just basically they're going to go with that. It's become the law on the 1st of July. The British Dental Association still say that it's an environmental issue, but they're going along with that side of it. Mm. And at least it shows that something's actually happening. It's the first time it's come into law. I mean, I've seen so many mercury crises over the years that just erupt, talked about and disappear.
Yes.
Hopefully this one is going to last.
Okay.
As it's in the statute, it's the first time I've seen it in a statute saying that there's going to be a ban, at least a partial ban of amalgams.
Mm. Right, so it's a partial ban for now. Is there a plan in place to move that on to a complete ban?
I think so. I think the politicians have now got to waffle among themselves for a while, and before they get to that stage. So I couldn't honestly say. I mean, I'm just so glad to see something come into law that actually, you know, ratifies the fact what I've been saying forever. Because I don't think, I mean, I'm not trying to say that that mercury fillings are kill everybody, get a problem to everybody, but they are potentially a toxin. And so why put a toxin into your body when there's plenty of decent alternatives?
Yes, absolutely.
And that's been my issue forever. I don't tell all my patients to get their amalgams out. I just tell them if you have any of these symptoms, think of this as a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And this is an EU ruling. So we're only just in the EU. So it is going to apply in Britain, is it?
It does apply to Britain. I mean, we're still in the EU, and unless there's any changes when Theresa May gets her stuff together or doesn't, it's going to remain as the statute in Britain. Mm, yeah,
that's a relief. But unfortunately, what happens in future in the EU is not going to necessarily have any impact at all on what happens here.
No. See, when they banned it in Sweden, I had a friend of mine who was advising the Swedish government, and it was actually, he told me it was done on environmental issues, not on the fact that an amalgam in your mouth is a very close source of mercury to a human body. And that was the waste. But because there are so many rules and regulations about how you get rid of waste amalgam, it's like a toxic material. And yet when it's put in your mouth, it's supposed to be safe. So that doesn't quite make sense to me.
It doesn't quite add up, does it? No. Well, unfortunately,
no.
You know, we're coming out of the EU. We're not exactly known for being leaders in the field of dealing well with the environment and toxins. So it doesn't bode that well for the law becoming more widespread.
It is. I mean, it's getting up there. I mean, when Jack Levinson first set up the Mercury Free Society back in 1980, in 81 we had a conference in Oxford, yes. And we had various academics, etc., came along there. All hell was let loose after that when they wouldn't release half the material on it, and it was just basically they just said, no, this is rubbish, and it was just. You know, and then I remember Jack turned around to me and said, okay, obviously the academics don't want to listen to us, so let's let the public know what's going on and let the pressure come from there.
Right.
And that's what he did until he died in 2004.
Right. Well, I think he was right about that. Change in these kind of areas of health isn't coming from within medicine anytime soon. Public pressure is the only hope, really. The whole desire of medicine seems to be carry on doing what we're doing. It's got an unusual name, this new ruling. It's got Minamata, is that how it's pronounced? Can you tell us about that?
That's Minamata. The Minamata, it was called that because back in about, I think it was the 50s, there was a whole bunch of mercury released into the waters and then outside Minamata, and there was... There was a whole bunch of report of people getting poisoned there with from mercury toxicity to the fish, and they were eating the fish.
Mm.
And that's what it's in honour of. It's actually that was the first time that mercury had been seen as a potential pollutant to the world.
So that's in Japan, yeah?
Yeah.
Japan's had its fill of toxic water, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's still got toxic water, but at least it doesn't seem to be from amalgam so much these days. It's just a lot of other things from what I can make out.
Yeah. Okay, so you were kind enough to send me a fascinating timeline of the fight against the use of mercury, which goes back a long way.
You've
just been talking about the 1980s. We won't have time to go into in detail, but would you just share some of the headlines?
Okay, well... As I say, the first time was back in the 1840 that it was first denounced as the use of it.
Wow.
But in 1859, the pro-amalgam faction in America formed its own dental association of the guys who wanted it, and called it, first of all, the National Dental Association. It later became the American Dental Association, which is still the one who decides what's right and wrong over there. And so the American society is divided into two. There was anti-amalgams and amalgams back then. And then there was nothing very much happened until 1973, when a fellow called Hal Huggins, who was well known in America for lecturing on nutrition, went to a conference in New Mexico, and he met a fellow, Dr. Pinto, there, and he actually had showed him evidence that how amalgam peels were unstable and mercury could trigger illnesses like Hodgkin's disease, etc., etc. And Hal told me then, he came back and thought, well, blown away, but the American people, American dentists better know this, started lecturing on it, and he spent his life defending what he meant, but surrounded by lawyers. And Hal was the one who really brought it back into the fore again, back in 73. Yeah, and then in 1980, Jack Levinson, whom I rented a practice from, started the British Society for Mercury-Free Dentistry, and he chaired that right up until his death in 2004, and did a lot of the research on it. So that's where it came from and here. And we were both very friendly with Hal, and I've been across and I've studied with him in Canada and his home base in Colorado. And he's a very interesting guy.
So, starting from, if we just take the timeline of the sort of modern fight against the use of mercury, that's been over 50 years. Until he got some success.
Absolutely.
We got partial success after more than 50 years. Okay. Yeah. So, mercury is a major toxin. Could you tell us in what way it's a toxin and what the effects are of exposure to it?
Well, there can be a whole lot of effects, because a lot of it is the way, if the toxin comes off your teeth and gets into the cellular tissues, often it depends on how individually strong the cellular tissue is. So if you've got a weak liver, that might be the one that's attacked. If you've got a weak heart, that might be one that's got attacked. But in basic essence, the mercury vapor evaporates from mercury fillings 24/7. And these fillings get into the gut, which can actually disturb the gut bacteria, which means you can actually get an issue with that. So the bacteria doesn't work and digestion doesn't work. And candida is one of the results of that.
Right.
But when the mercury gets into the gut or into the lungs, it gets transported by the blood down to the capillary level, where the capillaries are cell thick, the tissue cells are cell thick, and there's a process called osmosis happens. The cell sucks in the nutrients that the bloodstream's hanging down and spits out what it's finished with. Unfortunately, it's also results as taking in this mercury atom. And that was it getting on to one of the building materials of the body, which formed a molecule too big to get back out. So then it was stuck in the cells, and then the cells ceased to function quite so well. And it's simplest way of putting it, that's the way, how I explain it.
All right. And what would be the likely outcomes in terms of your health?
I've had people with... I've had people half dead. I've had one fellow who, a young fellow at 19, came to me with four biting surface amalgams. His mother had a lot of amalgams she was carrying, and that's one of the things that was shown by Murray Vimy and Rockshider back in the University of Calgary, showing that on a sheep they actually deliberately placed some amalgams in a pregnant sheep, and they found that the fetus got more amalgam than the sheep did.
Wow.
And anyway, Rory was running with a cell count of 20%, and because of this, I took the amalgams out, we detoxed them, and 6 months later, his level was back up to 90% normal, and now I treat his daughter. But he was had a lot of problems on the sexual side of it.
Right. Yeah, I supported a woman who eventually died of cancer, who she spent 10 years getting the NHS to actually recognise that she had an extreme reaction to amalgam that seriously compromised her health. I mean, it made every day a continual struggle, eventually leading to cancer. And, you know, over those 10 years, it was only the stuff that she paid for herself with private practitioners that was of any help at all. So it's I know firsthand what amazing effect it can have on your life, but also getting any recognition that this is even a condition to be acknowledged as like pulling teeth, if you'll excuse the expression.
No, it's fine. The trouble is when you place amalgam, the patient doesn't necessarily immediately get ill.
No.
And so when the patient does get ill 4 or 5 years later, they go to the doctors, not the dentist.
Yes.
And unless the doctors understand, and luckily we have a lot of environmental doctors who actually understand that an awful lot better than most fellows. But without that, there was just no correlation between amalgams and the toxicity in the body, because it was a timeline of, you know, necessarily 3, 4, 10 years between the placement of amalgams and then the breakdown of the tissues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know she had to find a toxicologist to get a supporting document from him to actually get the NHS to take any notice at all.
Yeah, and they were talking about allergies. It's not allergies, it's actually toxicity. And it's the way that it affects the system. Mm. I mean, they had a big conference in America about 2 months ago.
Yes.
And there was a lot of top dentists and environmental medical people talking about it. And 70% of them were saying that most of the problems in the body starts in the mouth.
Right.
And it actually hits it at cellular level. And that's what starts off the process.
Mm. Okay, well, serious stuff then. So, given what you've just been telling us, what about the health of dentists and dental workers, many of whom they presumably have amalgams themselves, and they have daily exposure to, you know, mercury vapour from their work?
Yeah, well, there was in Norway, they actually banned amalgam because 200 dental nurses complained of the toxicity,
right,
which actually changed that whole area there. Right. But, I mean, when I'm working at... I mean, what a lot of people don't quite understand is that when you take out an amalgam, you get an acute dose of mercury. Mm. It's not just, if you're having an amalgam, it's chronic, but when you take it out, it becomes an acute dose, and if someone's on the edge, that can throw you over the top. So when you're taking it out, you want to make sure that none of that mercury, acute mercury dose, can get into the system. Mm. So, I mean, I've used everything that, I mean, the only thing that I can see in the patient is actually the tooth. Everything else is covered and protected against any end release of that vapor.
Yeah, okay, well, that's what I wanted to go on to talk about, really, about getting practical. So lots of people are listening, particularly those maybe of more advanced years, have probably got a mouthful of amalgams and may want to consider doing something about it, but it's not as simple as just whipping them out, is it?
No, it's definitely not. I mean, you know, there's a particular order you take out. When I use electrical readings, and every patient I see for mercury sensitivity, I do a charting and I get all the clinical details sorted out. I also, in part of that, I also use a meter, which actually records electrical activity coming off across these fillings, which then dictates the optimum order of replacement.
Mm. Okay, what's the relationship between the electrical activity and why you would want to choose one over another?
Because when you take out an amalgam, and you never do them in a weekly cycle either. If you see someone on a Monday, you don't do another Monday. If you see someone on a Wednesday, you don't do another Wednesday. You could do a Monday, Wednesday and Friday, but there's a seven-day cycle for the immune cells and 7 days after you've taken out amalgam, there's a lot of immature immune cells, and if you hit them again, it could actually knock them silly.
Right.
So it's just another of the factors that I add into what I'm doing with patients.
Right. But the electrical activity indicates what exactly?
It's, well, the only vapor that, well, the only vaporization in the amalgam is actually the mercury. And it gives a level. It gives an idea of the level of mercury activity in that particular tooth.
I see.
And so you want to take the ones with the highest negative charge first.
Yeah.
And then take them out in order from there.
Right.
Right. And in some cases, you want to get one at a time when someone's very ill.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. And how about you've already started to describe the kind of thing you go through in taking them out, the precautions you take. Do you want to just go into that a bit more?
Yeah. When I'm taking them out, I mean, okay, obviously I give them an injection as normal. Then I isolate the area where I'm working on with a square of latex called rubber dam, so that I've isolated the teeth that I'm working on. Behind the rubber dam, I have a charcoal tablet because there's a concern that some of the mercury that we're taking out would vaporize through the micropores of the rubber dam, but charcoal will neutralize it all, and I also put suction in there, which helps. The patient's face is totally covered. They have a nose piece over them that's breathing well away from where I'm working. Mm-hmm. And also in front of them, a large machine that is sucking mercury vapor out constantly. And when I do the work, I use a high water jet in my drill, but my nurse also puts water jet in so I keep heat down. And also use very tungsten carbide bursts, which kind of they cut out the amalgam rather than grinding the amalgam out, so that also reduces the mercury vapor. Mm. And it's that sort of thing in general principle that one's looking at.
Mm. So it's quite an ordeal, really. It's a complex procedure.
Yeah, very often it takes me longer to protect the patient than it does to take the old restoration out.
I can believe it. Out of interest, I wondered if I could ask you about my own personal situation, and not just because I'm interested, but I thought it might tease out some answers that would be of interest to listeners. I was lucky enough to get through to adult life with just one amalgam, and I didn't actually go to the dentist for a decade or so, but a couple of visits to the dentist to set a good example to my growing daughter got me 3 more amalgams. So I thought, wait a minute, this is ridiculous. So I just stopped going.
Yeah.
And I never had another filling since in the last 35 years. But one of my 4 amalgams did fail, resulting in a horrible abscess. That was about the time that I became aware of the problems with amalgams. So I had that one pulled out. But then I went and had a mercury test to help me decide what to do with the others. And it seemed like my mercury levels were very low, so I decided to leave well alone. It was a bit like the thinking of leaving asbestos undisturbed in a house.
What test did they use?
That's a good question. It was too long ago for me to tell you exactly. But you're,
okay, because you know, I've got a laboratory that can do a blood test and send it to a lab in Europe where I can actually find out the mercury. The toxic levels that you've got.
Okay, well that sounds good. It's bound to be a lot more sophisticated just because of the passage of time, I expect. So in terms of an approach, though, would you validate that as an approach, given that it's obviously got to be a good test?
Yeah.
Does it make sense what I did, or should I have had them out anyway?
I would just have them out anyway. I mean, to be honest with you, though, I don't actually tell all my patients who've got, if I've got plenty of patients with amalgams in there, all I tell to these patients, if you've got some symptoms going on that nothing medically can sort itself out, then look at your amalgams as a possible solution.
Right, okay.
Another thing people need to realise, when you amalgam, apart from anything, the mercury actually sterilises things. It's using a lot of vaccines as well as a sterilizing agent,
yes,
which has been quite a bit of an issue.
Yes.
But very often when you've got a deep filling, that tooth is actually dead but no symptoms. You take out the amalgam and suddenly it flows into an abscess, which happened to one of my patients. I did warn them that could happen, and it happened just a couple of weeks ago. But it's just to realize that when you get the amalgams out, a deep mercury filling can actually keep the root canal sterile, even though there's bugs in it.
Right.
So it's just a little side issue to remember.
Okay.
But if there's small fillings you've got there, it's very simple to just take them out safely and replace them safely.
Okay. So you'd recommend that I got them done. That's good to hear. And someone who did a test, they should actually consider retesting if that's the route they're going to go down, to keep an eye on things. Would that be fair?
That's fair enough. For people who are having their amalgams out and want to check how they're doing, yeah. I would say that after a couple of months, because not you don't just take the amalgams out, you also need to go through a process of detoxing, where yes. you actually take the detoxing materials, yeah. which will actually come get into the bloodstream and actually suck out the amalgam, because you can take materials down there, and these detoxing materials hit the cellular and get sucked into the cell, and the mercury goes, well, I prefer you, and it latches onto the other and forms a different molecule which is small enough to get out, which is the basic principle of the detoxing process.
Yes.
But after a couple of months of that, I would suggest that patients then do a urine test, which gives you an idea of the body burden. And it's basically the test, you get two urine bottle samples, specific detoxing, which I let my lab work out according to body weight. Give a urine test, take the tablets, drink plenty of water over the next 2 or 3 hours, give another test, and the difference between the creatinine levels in there can give you an idea of what your body burden of mercury is like, and you can see just how well you've detoxed.
Right. Okay, that's good. I mean, so you are able to at least find out what kind of impact this is all having, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for that. So safe removal is a big deal, and it's a very specialised operation, and clearly you'd only entrust it to someone with the appropriate training.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Can we look at the alternatives now? There are some different materials being used, but mercury is not the only substance that's hazardous to health, and could be a case of out of the frying pan if we're not very careful.
yeah, that's true. Yeah, some of the composites were terrible.
Well, yes. I mean, if you think about the problems with plastics these days in relation to our health, it's all stuff they've known for decades, of course, as per the mercury. But, so you wouldn't want a material necessarily that got the wrong kind of plastics in it. So what kind of thing are they using now, and what are the best?
Well, composites with bis-GMA, which is a plasticizer in them, should not be used. They can affect the sexual cells very badly.
Right.
So that's one to miss. But if the filling's the right size, a straightforward composite without the bis-GMA in it works well. If it's a larger filling, you can use a zirconium inlays, which is a porcelain inlay.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes a tooth is just too small to take that, and you might need to make a zirconium crown. In other words, wrap around the cusp of the teeth, because the cusp of the teeth on either side of a filling are the bits that are solid and you actually chew on. If they're weak at all, they're liable to fracture, and sometimes you have to put a crown around them to prevent that.
Right.
And I mean, you can use glass ionomers, but glass ionomers can be used on a side filling where there's not weight bearing, but using them on the biting surface, which are a bit more weight bearing, they very often will fracture. Mm. But some people just have problems with composites, period, and sometimes you have to go into that situation with them.
Right, and when you say they have problems, what kind of thing?
It's just basically people just react to, they have an allergic reaction to composite, period. I mean, I with patients who have gone in any susceptibility of that, because I mean, I should say that when I see a new patient for the first time, I've also sent them a very exhaustive questionnaire, which actually picks up in three different questionnaires with to do with amalgam, and a fourth bit, which is just to do with the regular medical and dental stuff. But from these people, you can get an idea that might be sensitive. So what I do is I prepare some composite, set it, and then give them and tell them to take it home and do a suck test, whereas when you wake up in the morning, you take your resting pulse before you've done anything, no tea, no coffee, no nothing.
Right.
Then suck this material for a minute and then take it again. If the heart rate has gone up more than 10%, then it's possible you've got a sensitivity to it. Mm. And I found that is the most accurate reactionary thing that I've come out.
Mm. It's interesting that actually... I just did a program with somebody who'd written a book, which was largely a kind of self-help do-it-yourself book on general health and well-being, and that was one of her favourite tests for testing your reaction to all sorts of foods and things. And you know, dead simple, no expense, and just worked.
Yeah. And more accurate, because I spoke to Vera Stanskill, the one's Melissa, the testing group that I was talking about, and she reckons that she can happily test you for metal sensitivities. With composites, she's a bit iffy. They just don't give up, don't show up too well in any of these tests. Mm. And that's why I feel the composite, that's what I'm putting in, that's what it's set like, so try it and see whether you're all right with it. Yeah. That seems to work best.
Okay, and so do no metals get used at all now?
Occasionally, now sometimes clinically, if I have to make a crown, and for clinical reasons that it's not quite strong enough round the edges to take just pure zirconia, which is a completely porcelain crown, I will use a gold substructure. But the gold that I use is about 90% gold and 10%. Platinum, and it's the least sensitive material I come across. But then some people have just got sensitive to metal. I mean, I remember a lady I treated back in the 80s, 90s. Mm-hmm. She came into me and she had 3 NHS crowns in her upper right and 4 in the upper left, all pretty poor material. And it was before we had all porcelain crowns, so I made her, you know, pure gold and porcelain. Fitted in the ones on the left, she was fine. Fitted in the ones on the right, all hell let loose. She had a problem with cross-arch firing, and she was someone who actually had to completely rewire her home anyway, because she was just so reactive to metal waves of any kind.
You just said, was it cross-arch firing you said then? What does that mean?
It's cross-arch firing.
Yeah, what does that
mean? It meant that when you put gold in one side and gold in the other side, it fracks across the arch and reacts with it. And she was all right with the ones in the left where the temperatures were still in on the right. As soon as the ones on the right went in, and they were the exact same material as the ones on the left, all hell let loose again.
Right.
And I ended up just having to make her some composite fillings there, because we didn't have all porcelain crowns at that point in time. Because one of the problems with crowns was that because of the on the back teeth, you used to have to use metal as a substructure and then bond porcelain onto it to take the strength. You could make all porcelain crowns at the front, and now we've got zirconium crowns, so we don't have to do any of that. But at that point in time, composites were the only choice I had.
Okay, so now, I'd like to, as your kind of seasoned campaigner, I'd kind of like to step right back as far as we can and take a look at all the mechanisms at work behind, you know, issues such as amalgams, where the health of entire nations is put at risk. And there's another agenda going on, which is definitely working against us. I would say, from my own point of view, that the fundamental problem, I'm in no doubt, is the profit motive. This is actually what's driving healthcare, unfortunately, which is completely the wrong motive to get good healthcare. Would you agree with that?
I would agree, because part of what British Dental Association was saying was that, you know, if they're going to, you know, get the ban going by 2030 or something, they'll need to kind of refigure the fee structure they get in the NHS, for instance, because an amalgam takes half the time of a composite filling. So right. there's kind of a cost factor to the dentist there. And of course in America, they're absolutely petrified that the ban comes in, because they've got the American military and most of them have got amalgams.
Right.
And guess who'd be responsible?
Yes, that would be a very big bill. Yeah, so their dentistry is all included with their job, basically, and that's what they get the cheapest.
That's right, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, we've got this system that we work with, which, as far as I'm concerned, it's been developed to keep everyone on message with the corporate marketing plan. So you've talked about, obviously, worries, concerns about income for dentists, but
right.
You know, in the wider, if you look at the wider area of healthcare generally. The big key player, of course, is business, which is making medicines. And
right.
It seems to me that you have this setup which has been now very well established, where you've got regulatory bodies which are infiltrated and undermined by business interests. And then you have charities that are sponsored by business, often with key business people running them. And then you've got this medical system, which is a kind of top-down, fear-based, military-style system that suppresses whistleblowers, enforces uniformity, and it actually expels any kind of innovators. And lastly, you've got the governments that are in fear of the sheer power of the pharmaceuticals, who might threaten to go to another country if you don't behave yourself. And, and individual MPs who are given incentives to toe the line. So you've got this whole massive setup, which the result is that we have a time lag of 40 or 50 years, typically, until something gets outlawed, during which time, you know, there's open field day for business, basically. And, you know, that's most of a generation's lives, you know, 40 or 50 years. You know, you take an example like we have just now with the amalgams, that's one. Asbestos would be another one, where it took 50 years from when they knew it killed you until they actually made a law that says you can't use it anymore, by which time all the schools were full of it, the hospitals, the houses, it's everywhere. So, it's, you know, got this huge sort of rolling health tragedy going on, which we're all paying the price for. It's all very well, you know, you've got a victory there, which is fantastic, and I don't want to take anything away from that with enormous efforts, but the 50 years time lag is kind of obligatory, it seems, and that's killing us. What can we do about that time lag?
Oh, gently or generally?
I'm talking generally because it's the same issue wherever you go. There's, you know, there are forces at work holding back progress towards good health.
Well, I think there's also an aspect in human nature. You know, something seems to be working for them. Why do they want to change it?
Yes.
Someone's up with a new idea. You know, if it ain't broken, don't fix it type of thing.
Yeah.
So there is an element of that there. There's all an element of the people that are involved, except in the medical side of it, who were originally possibly trained as doctors and dentists in the medical field, and then they go on to the bureaucratic field.
Yep.
Where they don't work too well, or the bureaucrats who think they know about medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly know from some friends of mine who still work in the NHS, it's driving everybody crazy. There is nothing in the NHS, from my point of view, whether I'm a dentist of 40 years experience or a dentist of 4 years experience, I get the same fee.
Right.
And I'm so, you know, So it doesn't encourage you to think for yourself.
No.
And if your thinking's not quite what the powers that be want, they will try to find ways of making you toe the line, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I've been up against that a couple of times.
Yeah, absolutely. They're extremely heavy-handed when it comes to people who don't toe the line, and that's, you know, it's a massive problem. And it's one that, of course, it couldn't apply more than in cancer. You know, it's a terrible area of complete lack of progress, of a whole slew of evidence for good, wholesome approaches is completely ignored. Yeah, all because it's not profitable. So my own take at the moment is that the only way out of this jam, I mean, the notable thing about all the systems I described that are there to keep the things as they are, is that there's a new force at work, which is us, the public, which are not, we're not part of the system, and we do have a voice these days that we never had before. I mean, they're not listening yet, but we've got a voice, and I think we've got to really go for it if we're going to do anything about this 50-year time lag during which they, you know, businesses can poison us. We have to protest big time.
I agree. I mean, it's just a matter of I mean, I've never understood it. I mean, as far as I was concerned, the first time I came across mercury being an issue was a paper that I saw from about 1979, a fellow called David Eggleston in the States. Did Eggleston, he'd actually had a patient in, he was replacing all her amalgams and replacing them with gold, not in to do with mercury sensitivity, to do with the fact that gold was a better material, clinically wise. He'd done all the rest of them, he took out the last four amalgams, put in some plastic temporaries, and then sent her away for a couple of weeks while he made the gold inlay. What he missed out somewhere along the line, that this woman was in a study with a clone because her TPO, T8 cell ratio was out, which that's the one that controlled the immune system. And between seeing David and having amalgams out and getting the other ones fitted, she went and had a blood test and she was normal.
Right.
And everyone, oh. And so with her permission, David put four biting surface amalgams back in the surface of her temporary fillings and the ratio went out.
Right.
He took them out and it normalised. So, you know, there's been enough evidence out there to show that it's not going to give you, it's not going to work. Mm. But it's just having to persuade the powers that be that, you know, I mean, to a large degree, the reason that I think possibly is because the health service, they don't want to make it more expensive and composites take longer to place.
Mm. Well, you know, I agree. I think that does come into play in some instances, but I also know in cancer of instances where there's something that's far cheaper, has less side effects, and they actually developed it themselves. But it actually changes and threatens too many jobs, and they just can't do it. It's too cheap, actually, funnily enough, for them to do. Yeah, status quo is a difficult thing to combat.
It is, that's for sure.
Okay, we're coming to the end. I wonder if you can just tell us now, people who are interested in taking another approach to their dentistry, how do they find the people who are actually qualified to do it?
They can call up our society, which lists people in various parts of England, which is the British Society of Mercury-Free Dentistry. Mm-hmm. They can look up the IAMOT in America, who's got lists of people over here, but they've also got the IAMOT UK, and that's got a list of people who do this as well. I mean, there are other people who are not members of either society who do it safely, but everyone should ask if they do the SMART technique, which is a safe mercury amalgam replacement technique devised by the IAMOT.
Right. Okay.
And if the dentist says, "What are you talking about?"
You're going to
find another one.
Yeah. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. That's very helpful. Thank you. All right. Well, look, we're going to leave it there. Fascinating subject. Thank you so much for sharing that. Huge congratulations to you on the massive win for Europe and for us in the UK.
Thank you.
Yeah, brilliant.
Yep. Thank you. It's always
David.
It's been a long time coming.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. Take care.
As usual, you can find details of links to material mentioned by David on the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk. Click the Yes to Life show logo on the homepage. A reminder of the Yes to Life Walida Skincare Talk and Pamper Workshop. It's on the 19th of July in central London. Visit the Yes to Life Facebook page or the events page on the Yes to Life website to find out full details and to book. Also, if you want an autumn challenge, the Yes to Life 10K is on October the 6th. Go to yestolife10k.org, so that's yestolife10k.org, for details and for booking. I hope you'll be able to listen again next week. For now, goodbye.